Welcome to the Ordinary Extraordinary Cemetery, where every death had a life and every life had a story. My name is Jenny Johnson.
Hello, and I'm Diane Hartshorn.
And Diane and I have actually seen a lot of each other in this past week.
Yes, we have.
More than usual. Not that that's a bad thing. We've enjoyed it. But we recorded at the beginning of last week for last week's episode. And then we had the honor or the pleasure of being interviewed for an article in the American Cemetery and Cremation magazine. So thank you very much to Stan, who interviewed us, who's writing that article currently. I believe he told us the publication will come out in April with that particular story that he's doing on us.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. That was.
Yeah, so if you're a cemetery or you work for the cemeteries, you get that publication, watch for that article. We're super excited about it, which then prompted us yesterday, being Saturday yesterday, to meet up at Evergreen Cemetery in Colorado Springs, where we actually did a little mini photo shoot, because in the 2.5 years that Diane and I have been recording together, we have never taken any pictures together. So part of that is because we live an hour apart. So when we are recording, we're not together in person. But then when we've even hosted our Beyond the Grave events, we're both so busy running the event that we don't stop and take time to take a picture together. So we've never done it.
And so yesterday, the weather was perfect, even though it wasn't supposed to be, because Jenny came down later. And so we were worrying about the quote rain and stuff. And it was a little cloudy, but the sun came out right at the right opportune times. And well, you'll see the photos, but they were. And I hate having my photo taken. And I love these pictures. I love these pictures.
Yeah. These came out really good. So we will be posting them. You'll see them eventually on the website, social media. But I'm going to wait until I know which ones Stan wants to use with the article before I post anything with our stuff. But we had a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun to take them. And we appreciate Tom. Diane's husband was kind enough to be our photographer for the day and follow us around as we were like, oh, maybe we should go over here and maybe we should take a picture here and maybe, being patient with us. And we're like, wait, our hair or wait, our face.
Yeah, I look short. None of us ever say we look tall, but.
Yeah, we're both kind of on the shorter side, so.
And it was perfect because we were both familiar with the cemetery, because you've been very familiar with the cemetery with, you know, doing 2 years of Beyond the Grave. So we just have some really cool sites.
Yes, we had a lot of fun. So the pictures came out great. So we're recording on Sunday before this episode will come out, which we don't normally do on the weekends. It just timing wise worked out for both of us this week. So yes, we've seen each other almost 4 days in a row, which doesn't happen often, except when we're doing Beyond the Grave. And then we feel like we see each other all the time too. But
yeah, but that's fun.
That's fun. So today, we are wrapping up our three-part series on the 1692 Salem Witch Trials, our first ever three-part series on anything. So if you haven't listened to episodes 124 and 125, we suggest pausing this one here and going back to listen to those two first, especially if this is a new subject for you. So if you're not familiar with the witch trials, especially if you don't live in America, if you're in America, you've probably heard about them, but I know we have a lot of listeners outside of America and you may not have heard about them. So if you're just tuning in and you haven't listened in a while, I would go back and listen to the previous two episodes before you listen to us on this one. Last week, we left off with what was the final day of executions, although at the time it was unknown that that was the final day of executions. On that day, September 22nd, 1692, 8 victims, 6 women and 2 men, were hanged for the crime of witchcraft.
As we discussed in our last episode, the majority of the evidence presented to the court and which was used to determine the guilt of the witches was spectral evidence, meaning evidence based on supposed supernatural or paranormal events such as visions, dreams, or ghostly apparitions that were causing physical harms to those being afflicted. And only those being afflicted were able to see and describe it. By September of 1692, the judges of the Court of Oyer and Terminer had been warned more than once on relying too heavily on spectral evidence, but they continued to allow and based most of their judgments and sentences on the spectacles being conveyed by the afflicted girls at each of the trials.
Yeah. And mostly because there was no other evidence. So all they could go by was what these girls were doing in court. On October 3rd, Increase Mather, a prominent Boston minister and the father of Cotton Mather, gave a speech at a meeting of ministers in Cambridge, Massachusetts, in which he strongly criticized the use of spectral evidence in the trials for witchcraft that were taking place at that time. In his speech, Mather argued that the use of such evidence was unreliable and that it could easily lead to the wrongful conviction of innocent people. He stated, "It were better that 10 suspected witches should escape than one innocent person should be condemned." This statement became famous and is often quoted today as a testament to the importance of due process and the presumption of innocence in our current legal system. And I misspoke last week. I said that Cotton Mather had initially been the one to warn the judges against accepting spectral evidence. I actually meant to say Increase, his father. Initially, Cotton was okay with it. Cotton Mather, who was also a prominent minister and intellectual of the time, initially supported the use of spectral evidence in the trials for witchcraft, but he eventually came to agree with his father's position and began to publicly speak out against the use of such evidence. However, Cotton Mather's earlier support for the trials and his association with some of the judges who presided over them would later tarnish his reputation and contribute to his legacy as a controversial figure in American history.
By this time, more and more people were beginning to side with Increase Mathers, and public outcry against the trials was mounting pressure on those in charge to rethink the handling of the proceedings. Massachusetts's new governor, Sir William Phipps, feeling the sting of this pressure, officially dissolved the Court of Oyer and Terminer in Massachusetts on October 29, 1692. A new court was established to try the remaining cases of those accused of witchcraft. This new court was called the Superior Court of Judicature. The judges of this court required more substantial evidence before convicting anyone of witchcraft, and they also allowed defendants to have legal representation and to call witnesses in their defense, something the previous accused were not allowed.
So if you go back historically and you look at our current legal system, some of the things that we do now are a direct result of things that happened during these trials and things that were part of English common law at the time, which because we weren't our own country yet, we right. were still following English common law. So when you think of the unfairness of not having representation, not being allowed to call witnesses, that was normal at the time. But also it's what led to so many of the executions. While the Superior Court of Judicature did not have a formal policy on the use of spectral evidence, it generally required more substantial evidence to convict someone of witchcraft than the earlier court had. This meant that spectral evidence was less likely to be considered on its own and instead had to be supported by other more tangible evidence. So they needed to present actual proof that witches were causing problems. Ultimately, the use of spectral evidence became increasingly rare as the Salem witch trials drew to a close.
On December 16, 1692, the General Court of Massachusetts issued an order for the Superior Court to convene a special session on January 3, 1693, to hear the remaining cases of those accused of witchcraft who were still being held in jail. On January 31st, of 1693, Governor William Phipps intervened in the Salem witch trials by issuing reprieves for 8 other individuals who were scheduled to be executed on February 3rd. The 8 individuals had been found guilty of practicing witchcraft by the Court of Oyer and Terminer in 1692 and were awaiting execution.
So yes, those trial, or fortunately, those folks did not get hanged because of this. In issuing the reprieves, Phipps ordered a full review of the evidence presented against the accused and appointed a new commission to investigate the trials. The commission was tasked with determining the validity of evidence presented against the accused and to identify any errors in legal procedure. The reprieves were a significant turning point in the Salem witch trials, as they marked the first instance in which the government began to question the validity of the trials and the evidence presented against the accused. Phipps's decision to order a review of the trials and to appoint a new commission demonstrated a newfound commitment to due process and fairer trials. Furthermore, upon paying their jail fees, all of those accused of witchcraft were now officially free to go. And again, we talked about this last episode. You had to pay for your jail time. So if you couldn't, even though he had excused you from being a witch, you may still be held in jail because you still had to pay for your time in jail. In May 1693, Governor Phipps pardoned Mary Bradbury, along with several others who had been accused of witchcraft, and they were finally released from prison. Mary Bradbury was the last person accused of witchcraft in 1692 to be released. She had been in prison since April of 1692. So she was there almost a full year.
Oh, I can't. I mean, we talked about this last week too. The conditions of those jails must have been just horrific.
Horrible. And we have to keep in mind, they weren't all in jail in Salem because Salem's jail was not that big. Some of them were held in jails in nearby cities of Ipswich, Boston, and a couple other places. So they weren't all in the Salem jail necessarily. They were in jails scattered throughout Essex County and other parts of Massachusetts.
Of course, life was never the same for those who lived through this extraordinary year. One of the most tragic cases was that of little Dorothy, or Dorcas Good, who was only 4 years old at the time she was accused and arrested and confessed to being a witch during her trial. It was some of her testimony that led to the death of her mother, Sarah Good. Dorcas spent 7 months of her young life in prison. By all accounts, she suffered mental anguish for the remainder of her life. She would die at the tender age of 16. Her burial location is unknown.
Yeah, she, so Sarah Good was one of the first women to be accused, and of course, not one of the more popular women in town. She did, and we didn't get into it when we talked about Sarah before, she did get a sort of reprieve like Elizabeth Proctor because she was pregnant initially, but she gave birth to her baby kind of at the height of all of this. So she was still executed after her baby was born. But Sarah was not executed. And part of that was because, or I mean, not Sarah, Dorcas was not because she confessed to being a witch. But think about it. She was 4 years old, kind of like Tituba. She probably finally said whatever it was those magistrates wanted her to say. And this would have been after examining her for witches' marks, beating her, everything. And any little kid under enough coercion is going to say what they adults want to hear. So that unfortunately scarred that poor little girl for life. And she never did lead a normal life after that. Mm-hmm. And it was very short-lived. Elizabeth Proctor, who had been spared execution due to her pregnancy, was eventually cleared of all charges in 1693. Fortunately, Elizabeth lived the rest of her life as a respected member of the community, and in 1699, she successfully petitioned for compensation from the Massachusetts government for her husband's wrongful conviction and execution. She's one of the few that actually received compensation. There were others that tried and weren't as successful, but I think because the Proctors were a more prominent family to begin with, that probably helped. In 1711, Elizabeth Proctor passed away at the age of 74. The exact location of Elizabeth Proctor's grave is not known for certain. She is believed to have been buried in the Proctor family cemetery, which is located near the intersection of Proctor and Pope Roads in Peabody, Massachusetts. However, the cemetery itself no longer exists, and the land where it once stood has been developed. In 1892, a memorial marker was placed in memory of John Proctor and other victims of the Salem witch trials at the intersection.
The sons of Giles Corey, John and Thomas, were eventually able to recover some of their father's property following the trials and became well-established members of the Salem community. Both married and each had several children. John Corey served as a selectman and a deputy sheriff in Salem. Thomas Corey served as a constable, a selectman, and a justice of the peace, and he was involved in various land transactions and other business ventures.
The family of Rebecca Nurse continued to honor her memory and fought to restore her good name long after her death. Despite the stigma and trauma of Rebecca's conviction and execution, her family continued to live in Salem Village for many years after the trials. In 1711, the Massachusetts legislature passed a resolution exonerating Rebecca and several other victims of the witch trials. The Rebecca Nurse Homestead is the only house belonging to one of the victims that is open to the public. So there are some of the other houses standing that belong to the victims' families. So these are houses that were built in 1600. They're still there. People still live in them. Hers is the only one open to the public. On the grounds of the homestead is a family cemetery. It has long been believed that after her execution, Rebecca's family snuck back to the execution site in the middle of the night to retrieve her body and rebury it in their private cemetery, although there is no official written record of this. Her grave was left unmarked, but she is surrounded by other members of the nurse family who loved her dearly. Buried in the same cemetery is believed to be another victim of the trials, George Jacobs Sr.
Just as Rebecca Nurse's family had done, it is believed that many of the victims were removed under cover at night and buried in private, unmarked graves near their homes. The same is believed to have happened to George Jacobs Sr. The descendants of George Jacobs Sr. stated that they had located his grave on the family farm in 1864. In 1950, during construction work by developers, the grave was discovered and the bones were dug up. Although it cannot be confirmed with certainty that the remains belong to George Jacobs Sr., they match the description of an elderly man fitting his characteristics. 300 years after the Salem witch trials in 1992, the bones were placed in a 17th century style coffin and reburied at the Rebecca Nurse Homestead's family cemetery.
And there is a slate headstone for him that was made in the likeness of the ones from the 1600s to mark that burial spot. Of course, life went on for the accusers and those who brought judgment against the victims as well. As we stated in our last episode, the Putnam family was one of the prominent families involved in the Salem witch trials, particularly Thomas Putnam and his wife, Anne. They were among the accusers who made numerous accusations against their neighbors, resulting in the arrests and executions of many innocent people. After the trials, the Putnam family faced significant backlash from the community. Many people believed that they had abused their power and falsely accused others of witchcraft. Despite the criticism and stigma associated with their involvement in the trials, the Putnam family continued to live in Salem Village and remained involved in local politics and affairs. Some members of the family, including Thomas's son, Israel Putnam, became prominent figures in the American Revolution and went on to play important roles in the early years of the United States.
Their daughter, Anne Putnam Jr., was the most vocal among the young women during the trials and claimed to suffer much affliction. However, on August 26, 1706, at the age of 27, Anne Putnam Jr. offered a public apology for her role in the Salem witch trials. This was a significant event because it was one of the few public acknowledgments of wrongdoing by someone involved in the Salem witch trials. During the trials, Anne had been a key accuser, and her testimony had helped to convict many people of witchcraft.
In her statement of faith, which was read aloud by Reverend Green, and while Anne was standing in front of the congregation, she stood while the Reverend read her letter, Anne apologized for her role in the trials and acknowledged that she had been misled by the devil. She said, "I desire to be humbled before God for that sad and humbling providence that befell my father's family in the year about 92, that I then, being in my childhood, should, by such a providence of God, be made an instrument for the accusing of several persons of a grievous crime, whereby their lives were taken away from them, whom now I have just grounds and good reason to believe they were innocent persons."
Anne's apology was a significant departure from the stance taken by many of the accusers and officials involved in the trials, who never admitted that they had made mistakes or acted wrongly. The members of the Putnam family who were involved in the trials are buried together in the private Putnam family cemetery, located next to the Massachusetts State Police Barracks. Thomas Putnam and Anne Putnam Sr. died within 2 weeks of one another in 1699. Anne Jr. died in 1716.
Judge John Hawthorne never showed any remorse for his part in the trials. After they were ended, he retained his seat on Boston's governing council and later became the commander-in-chief in the failed siege of Fort Nashawak in Nova Scotia in 1696, following in his father's military footsteps. In 1702, Hawthorne was appointed to the Superior Court, a position he held for 10 years before resigning from the bench in 1712. He died on May 10, 1717, at the age of 76, and was buried in the Old Burying Point Cemetery on Charter Street next to the Salem Witch Trials Memorial, which, of course, was not there when he was buried. Interestingly, some of John Hawthorne's descendants married descendants of the accused witches, Mary and Philip English, and also John Proctor.
It is difficult to determine Corwin's stance on the Salem Witch Trials, as he allowed Hawthorne to lead most of the pre-trial interrogations, and he never made any public statements regarding the trials before, during, or after them. Corwin served as the judge of the Essex Inferior Court of Common Pleas from 1692 to 1708. He later became the Commissioner of Excise and Impost on June 24, 1692, and then from 1698 to 1702, he served as a judge of probate. On November 23, 1703, Corwin and John Hawthorne were both appointed to preside over the murder trial of Native American named Mamusin in Salem. The book, Storm of Witchcraft, asserts that Corwin and Hawthorne are forever linked due to their collaboration during the witch trials and their shared characteristics. Jonathan Corwin passed away on June 9, 1718, a year after John Hawthorne, and was interred in the Corwin family tomb located in the Broad Street Cemetery in Salem.
The Witch House was the home of Judge Jonathan Corwin and is one of the few structures you can visit in Salem with direct ties to the Salem Witch Trials of 1692. And we did mention this house last week. Jonathan Corwin purchased the house in 1675. At the time, he was heir to one of the largest Puritan fortunes in New England. The house is currently located on the corner of Essex and North Streets in Salem. An interesting side note about the property is it is thought to be where the early 1630s home of Roger Williams once stood. Williams, who was the acting pastor of the Salem Church in 1634, believed that Native Americans should be paid for their land and that church and state should be separate. These diverse, new, and dangerous opinions, in quotes, did not sit well with the Puritan leaders of the Salem area, and he was convicted of sedition and heresy. Williams ended up fleeing south in January of 1636 and eventually founded the state of Rhode Island. The witch house has never had any accused witches living in it, but it does offer a fascinating glimpse into the daily life of a person of means in 17th century New England. It is open to the public and there are guided and self-guided tours available. And it is quite fascinating.
Oh, I bet it is.
Yes.
Another individual tied to the trials who we have not talked about at all was George Corwin, High Sheriff of Essex County. He was nephew to Judge Jonathan Corwin, as well as one of the other judges, Waite Winthrop. George Corwin was only 25 years old when he was appointed High Sheriff. His duties in this position included signing arrest and death warrants, confiscating personal property, such as money, goods, housewares, and livestock, and carrying out execution. It was George Corwin who carried out the atrocious act of pressing Giles Corey. He showed no mercy to his victim. At one point, Corey's tongue protruded from his mouth due to the pressure. Corwin borrowed an onlooker's walking stick and forced Corey's tongue back in his mouth. For centuries, rumor has said that Corey placed a curse on Salem and its sheriff during his torture when he shouted, "Damn you, I curse you and Salem," at the sheriff before he died. George Corwin died of a heart attack on April 12, 1696, at the age of 30 years old. Local legend says that it was Giles Corey's curse that killed him and that the curse also killed many Essex County sheriffs since 1692. He is buried at the Corwin family crypt in the Broad Street Cemetery in Salem.
There's actually a whole lot more to that story that I didn't actually put in the script because I couldn't figure out how I wanted to word it. But whether Corey actually said that curse, I mean, it's legends. My guess is that part didn't happen, that it came down over time as people got used to the idea of these stories. However, it is curious that up until 1980 something, every sheriff that served in that position did die of a heart attack. And so that's part of where that legend came from. Eventually, they moved the Salem jail from its original location elsewhere. Once it moved out of Salem, once it was no longer the jail, none of those sheriffs from that time on seemed to be affected by this supposed curse and did not die of heart attacks. But that was up until like 1981 or 19, or maybe even 1990 something. I don't know. It was a very long period where a large majority or every single one of the sheriffs did end up dying of a heart attack.
Because I think we had discussed that on a podcast a year or so ago. Because I remember the curse, and now Mr. Corey was not. Oh no, was not Mr. Corey.
Yeah, well, there is also the story saying that if you see Giles Corey's ghost haunting one of the other cemeteries in town, that something horrible will happen following that. And we had talked about, I think when we did our episode on the 1914 fire in Salem, there were rumors that his ghost had been sighted shortly before that incident, as well as some other incidents. Again, that's legend and lore. There's no proof that that's ever happened. But it is an interesting coincidence that so many sheriffs who took over that position after George Corwin. The other part with George Corwin is, so Philip English, who we did not talk about, but Philip English was a very wealthy merchant that lived in Salem at the time. And he and his wife were both accused of witchcraft. However, they were able to, and they had a bunch of their property confiscated, right? And personal belongings. They were not executed, fortunately. They survived. Long after the trials, Philip English actually sued George Corwin to get back a large portion of his property or money that he'd lost during this whole thing. And it became a very embittered lawsuit that lasted quite a while. And I don't remember all the details to it. But when Corwin died, his family was concerned that the Phillips family might desecrate his grave because there was still so much anger between it. So his body was actually buried in the cellar of his house, which the house itself no longer stands, but another house was built on that spot. That house that currently is on that spot is now a bed and breakfast that you can stay in, or a hotel. I have been inside it. I have taken pictures of it. I have not stayed there, but it's gorgeous. But eventually his body was removed from the cellar and put in the cemetery when it was felt like it was safe that his remains would no longer be desecrated. But there was fear that he would be desecrated, because not only the Phillips family, but there were so many families that George Corwin had sort of terrorized when he was sheriff and making the arrest and taking all their property. And a lot of that he was able to keep for himself. It was part of his payment for doing the job of sheriff. That was kind of how they considered him to be paid. So there are court records that even at one point sided with him, saying, oh no, he can keep all of that. It was perfectly legal. And in fact, we still owe him additional money for the job that he did during those trials. So yeah, you can, I know folks can't see Diane. I can see her as we're recording, and she's like shaking her head in like disbelief that happened. Yeah. But George, so we didn't really get into George Corwin, but he was a significant part of the witch trials and kind of one of the reasons some of the bad blood existed for so long after the trials.
Him. Makes perfect sense.
In 1945, a bill was introduced to clear the names of those convicted during the Salem witch trials, the ones that hadn't been cleared back in 1711. But it took 12 years for a resolution to be passed that pardoned Anne Pruditer and certain other persons without formally naming any of those persons. In October of 2001, Susanna Martin, Bridget Bishop, Alice Parker, Margaret Scott, and Wilmot Redd were formally cleared of all witchcraft charges. However, it was discovered in August of 2021 that one name had been erroneously overlooked, Elizabeth Johnson Jr. Thanks to the work of historian Richard Hite and an eighth grade class in North Andover, Massachusetts, legislature was introduced to clear her name, and she was officially exonerated in August of 2022.
That is amazing.
And so now,
eighth grade students.
Every single victim has been officially exonerated and cleared of any wrongdoing in these witch trials. But it took from 1693 all the way up until 2022.
And not to, you know, to say anything or accuse anything, but it seems like the women were the last to be exonerated over the men before the men. As we've stated, we do not know where most of the victims who were executed or who died in prison are actually buried, though there is speculation for many of them. If their families did remove their bodies after the execution, the locations were never recorded in writing and were only passed down through word of mouth. However, as time has passed and the descendants of both the victims and the accusers began to accept and acknowledge the atrocities of 1692, several memorials have been erected in honor of the victims. One of the first was the Witch Trial Memorial, which is located just outside the walls of Salem's oldest burying ground, the Charter Street Cemetery. The memorial is surrounded by stone walls on three sides, with stone slabs inserted among them. Each slab contains the name of the executed, along with their execution date. A dirt path runs beside the benches for visitors to walk and reflect. Trees grow down the center of the memorial. One can read on the stone threshold of the memorial words of the accused taken directly from court transcripts. Visitors will note that the words among them, quote, "God knows I am innocent," unquote, are cut off in mid-sentence, representing lives cut short and indifference to the protestations of innocence. The Salem Witch Trials Memorial was dedicated on August 5th, 1992, by Nobel laureate, Holocaust survivor, and author Elie Wiesel, who noted, quote, "If I can't stop all of the hate all over the world in all of the people, I can stop it in one place within me." Adding, "We still have our Salems," unquote.
In Danvers, formerly Salem Village, you can find the Witchcraft Victims Memorial, also erected in 1992. This memorial not only recognizes those who were executed, but also those who died while imprisoned. The memorial features a granite Bible box and book with a pair of large-scale reproduction metal shackles. Behind the Bible box is a three-panel granite wall on which are inscribed the names of those who died, along with the date and circumstances of each death and the town of each victim's origin. Also inscribed on the walls on each side are quotations from eight of the accused, including this from Elizabeth Howe: "If it was the last moment I was to live, God knows I am innocent."
On July 19th, in 2017, the 325th anniversary of the hangings of Sarah Good, Elizabeth Howe, Susanna Martin, Rebecca Nurse, and Sarah Wilds, a third memorial was dedicated at the site known as Proctor's Ledge, where it is believed the hangings took place. According to SalemWitchMuseum.com, for many years, it was believed that the 19 innocent people who were executed in Salem in 1692 were hanged at the summit of Gallows Hill on the edge of town to the west. The exact site was not memorialized. After all, this was a shameful event the Salem residents wanted to leave in the past. Maps of 1700 Salem show Gallows Hill, but no marker for the execution site. In 1921, local historian Sidney Purley believed he had located the spot of the executions near the base of the hill on Proctor's Ledge. His conclusion led to the city of Salem to purchase part of Proctor's Ledge in 1936, calling it Witch Memorial Land. No memorial was built. However, and until 2016, most people still believe the executions took place at the summit. A team of researchers began to reconsider all the evidence in 2010 and eventually concluded that Purley was right. The real execution spot was confirmed as Proctor's Ledge in January of 2016. Part of the evidence included 1692 eyewitness accounts of nearby neighbors who were able to see the hangings from their homes. Embedded in a semicircular wall are stones engraved with the names of the 19 victims. If you are thinking of visiting this particular memorial, please note, the memorial is located in a residential neighborhood. There is no parking, so visitors are advised to park at Gallows Hill Park and walk down the hill to the site.
Yes. And there's, in case you're wondering, there's a, I think it's a Walgreens or a CVS, it's a pharmacy that's located kind of on the other side of it. You cannot park in their parking lot either. They have signs all over the place that said memorial visitors are not to park in their parking lot. So, and just if you do visit this particular one, the other two memorials that we mentioned, the actual witch trial memorial, which is near the cemetery, and the one in Danvers, are located in like public spaces. This one is literally right across the street from a bunch of houses where people actually live and, you know, conduct their daily business. So if you do go visit, be very respectful of the fact that there are people living right there. They look out their living room windows. They can see that site. And you're on the sidewalk. If you're standing across the street from the memorial, you're actually on the sidewalk in front of their homes. So just be very respectful if you go in search of that particular memorial. Fortunately, I have been able to visit all three of those memorials on my various trips there. And they're all extremely moving and extremely well done. And a great way to honor people whose burials, like I said, are guessed in a lot of cases. We have some idea of where some of them are buried, but the you know, bodies have never actually been discovered. And at this point may never be discovered because it's been so long. I mean, nearly 400 years wow. is a long time. And most likely if they were wrapped in a shroud of some sort, they've returned to dust as they should have. So we probably never will know the exact locations, but this at least gives us a way to honor and remember the victims and just the horribleness of the entire outcomes of these particular trials.
We are so glad you have joined us for the past 3 weeks to learn about the 1692 Salem Witch Trials. If you want to learn even more, please visit our website, theordinaryextraordinarycemetery.com, where you will find resources we used as well as links to places in and around Salem to visit.
And I'm also planning to link some books in there. So like we said a little bit ago, there's a lot of people we ended up not discussing in these last three episodes because there were so many victims. There's also several judges we never got to talking about. We talked about Hawthorne and Corwin because they were sort of the two biggest, most infamous names of the judges. But there are several other judges that were involved who left journals and information about what they went through when they were judging these trials. So I will link all of that in our show notes if you're interested in learning more. And yes, if you're planning a trip to Salem and you want to visit some of these sites that are related to the trials and the victims and everything, I'll have all that information linked in our show notes this week. So also, in addition to visiting our website, please be sure to visit us on social media. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram at Ordinary Extraordinary Cemetery and on Twitter at Ord Extra Sim. If you enjoyed this episode or any of our previous episodes, please consider leaving us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or directly on our website. This helps others who love cemeteries and history to discover us.
Until we meet again.